Welcome to Climate Radio. For the remaining shows this year, we plan to get back to focusing on the positive, on solutions, what's working now, and what we need to do urgently to avoid the worst effects of climate change while building a fairer, more just world. But for one last show, we're going to look at how policymakers are falling for yet another form of extreme energy. If drilling for oil in deep water and in the Arctic, developing tar sands and fracking the land for gas weren't enough, the UK and Europe are now at the leading edge of the drive to burn trees instead of coal in power stations. This is a form of electricity generation commonly known as biomass. According to a new assessment, European consumption patterns are already responsible for over a third of global deforestation. Giving subsidies to power companies to burn trees will add massively to this demand, which in turn will exacerbate climate change, biodiversity loss, and land grabbing. On the upside, the scientific rationale for this policy has been shown to be nothing more than the Emperor's new clothes. As European and UK policymakers stand exposed, will the public take the initiative and demand they take account of what the science is actually saying? To find out more, we spoke to Harry Highton, Head of Climate and Energy Policy at the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds.
Okay, so the UK government and the EU have decided that burning wood in power plants is carbon neutral. Why don't RSPB, Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth agree?
Okay. So there are carbon emissions associated with burning wood throughout the production and transport chain. So when the wood is harvested, then transported and then processed into pellets and fed into the power station, there's emissions associated with all of those stages. Government and industry have accepted that, but what they haven't accepted is that there are also emissions associated with the act of actually burning the wood itself. And our view is that that is one of the key sources of greenhouse gas emissions associated with wood. So, like any organic material, when you burn it, CO2 is released. And the industry and government argue that we don't need to count those emissions because they're automatically neutralised by regrowth in the forest. The problem with that argument is that it ignores the time period over which those emissions are re-neutralised. And in reality, most studies, so if you look, for example, at the most recent review by the European Commission's Science Department, the Joint Research Centre, they find that it can take, in their review of peer-reviewed literature, that it can take anything from 0 to 500 years for those emissions to become carbon neutral.
Right. So this is the kind of concept of carbon debt, if you like, when trees are burnt in power stations, the amount of time that it takes for trees regrown to replace those trees and absorb this equivalent amount of carbon is the carbon debt? Is that how it works?
Yeah, it's carbon debt, and it's highly variable according to the tree species, what part of the tree was used for energy, whether it was actually the whole tree or whether it was perhaps just some arising, so the offcuts from a tree that was harvested for another industry, and it depends on where it's happened as well. So obviously, tree, you know, regrowth is faster in certain areas than in others. And that's why you get that big variability in that figure of 0 to 500 years.
Right. It is a big range. But the searching report that your Dirtier Than Coal analysis relies on, they looked at a kind of, correct me if I'm wrong, a kind of average conifer plantation, you know, the kind of idealised managed forest, if you like. Mm-hmm. What time period did that take to absorb all the CO2 associated with burning trees?
Well, the Dirty and Control Report used one case study to make this point that carbon debt can be a problem. And it actually used a case study that Sertzing himself had used, but it was based on a study commissioned by the UK's and government. And in that study, they looked at typical conifer plantations in the UK, and they looked at a whole multitude of scenarios for how those plantations might be managed and then how the harvested wood might be used. And they showed that if you end up using the whole tree for energy generation, then over a 40-year time period, you still have a 49% increase in greenhouse gas emissions relative to coal. And it's only really after 100 years that you get a kind of a benefit for the climate. That's one instance. And there are many other, as I say, studies looking at different trees, different forests in different parts of the world that come out with similar kind of findings. Mm. Now, that leaves you with the question, well, will whole trees be used? And you could argue that the UK, we don't have very much forestry in the UK. It's already got existing markets. Bioenergy might just take up what's left, you know, after the quality wood has gone to existing industries. That might well be what happens. The point is, though, at the moment, government policy makes absolutely no distinction between whether you're using the waste wood from a sawmill or whether you're using a whole tree. So you will still get your subsidy if you're using a whole tree. And we're already seeing in other markets, so in the US, for example, where there is evidence emerging that whole trees are indeed entering the biomass chain and ending out in UK power stations.
Okay, just to wind back a second to the searching a report again. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Committee on Climate Change is recommending, and so are lots of other people, that we need this amendment to the Energy Bill that says we should virtually decarbonise our electricity sector by 2030. That's less than 20 years away. Searchinger says that if we burn trees, you know, from conifer plantations in our power stations, by 2030, the trees we burn today, there isn't a carbon saving. It's actually 80% greater emissions than coal. So we're actually going to be moving away rather than towards decarbonising our energy supply by 2030 if we continue down the biomass road.
So I think we've got to be very careful, because remember, the searching study and the Dirty and Coal study said, in this one instance, if you use conifers from the UK, actually conifers from the UK is a small resource. UK power stations will be using wood from all over the world. So keep that 0 to 500 years thing in your mind, because it is a big range. But what we do know is that there are absolutely no guarantees that this is going to reduce emissions as it stands, and it may well increase them as a result of carbon debt. So in terms of the decarbonisation target, I think this is a critical issue. And it's also a critical issue for our 2020 target. So we have a EU target of generating 15% of our energy from renewables, and according to action plans from each of the member states, you know, about half of that will come from bioenergy of some kind, with biomass electricity, i.e. wood-fired electricity, playing a big role in it. So this is a real problem, because it's not what it says on the tin. We're saying we're decarbonising our electricity supply, but in this case, we can't be confident at all the biomass electricity is doing that. We have been... Well, originally, in fact, we put forward amendments to the Energy Bill that would ensure that decarbonisation targets counted actual emissions from biomass. That's the way to do it. That hasn't gone forward. In fact, the decarbonisation target itself hasn't gone forward. And that's disappointing. So What we're doing now is we're suggesting that the emission performance standard, which is a kind of maximum amount of carbon emissions that will be permissible from any individual coal power plant, we are suggesting that that be amended so that it doesn't make the same mistake of counting emissions from biomass as zero, and so that it can properly reflect actual emissions from bioenergy. And because it looks like, in the UK at least, most of wood-fired electricity will be in converted coal power plants, we think this will be a good way of making sure we have some control over how much wood these plants burn, and we're able to limit it if the evidence suggests that emissions associated with what they're doing are higher than anticipated.
Yeah. Is that a formal amendment that's been put in?
It was actually tabled just this week in the Lords.
Okay. And do you anticipate much political support for that?
I think the debate over biomass in the Commons, you know, when the Energy Bill was going through the Commons, started from a very low level. I think MPs were unaware of the scale of what was going on. And the amendment and the debate put a spotlight on that. And it showed some MPs who were willing to scrutinise these plans and to hold them to account, as it were. But it has been a divisive issue for a very simple reason, that these power plants have jobs associated with them. If we take away support for things like biomass conversion, it raises some really big questions about how are we going to meet our targets, are there any impacts on energy security, and I think politicians have found those difficult to deal with. But there is growing support for action to be taken, and so I hope we will see politicians get behind this.
I mean, the government seemed to be standing behind their sustainability criteria as a justification that everything will be okay with their policy. But perhaps you can give me your verdict about the sustainability criteria. They seem to be unlikely to be enforced with any degree of vigour. They seem to be voluntary, kind of self-reporting requirements, you know, perhaps just tick-box exercises conducted by industry sustainability consultants, that kind of thing. And already we're seeing the wood for Drax coming from not just managed forests in the US, but natural forests from swamps in North Carolina.
Yeah. So to be brutally frank, we've already seen sustainability standards fail for transport biofuels, and we think they will fail again for biomass. So exactly the reasons you give. These are lax standards with lax kind of third-party auditing, and therefore we can't be confident they will deliver what the industry are telling us. So there are two standards the government has put forward. First is that generators should comply with the government procurement standards, and the second is a carbon standard. On the procurement, effectively, all it means is that you need to have some kind of paper trail that demonstrates compliance with whatever the national forestry laws might be. I don't have confidence in that, and I particularly don't have confidence with that when we're thinking about some of the countries that the wood is already coming in from, for example, Russia. But as you said, we're already seeing problems associated with wood that is being sourced from North America. The second standard that they are proposing is a carbon standard, and the carbon standard only counts those emissions associated with harvesting the wood, transporting the wood, and then processing it, which is fairly fundamentally flawed given the main source of emissions is the carbon that goes out of the chimney, and how that compares to the change in carbon stock in the forest. Both of those are completely ignored, and therefore we can't really take this greenhouse gas standard seriously at all.
Mm. And the scientific background to all of this seems to have shifted somewhat over the last few months with the release of the report that you mentioned right at the beginning, the EU Science Committee report, which was a high level literature review, saying that the assumption that biomass is carbon neutral is false, and that's the basis on which EU and UK policy is based. Have we seen any indication from the government that they are looking at this and listening to what the science is saying, or is it a case of they seem to be willfully ignoring it?
I think over the past couple of years, actually, we've seen a growing amount of peer-reviewed literature that describes this problem, and the report by the European Union's Science Department effectively brings all of that together and draws headline conclusions from it. So there's a lot of science here. But the other thing I would say is I'm not surprised by any of this science, because it's also common sense, frankly. What are government doing about it? They are unfortunately standing by this fundamentally flawed greenhouse gas standard. But the Department for Energy and Climate Change did commission some work from the science unit within their department to look at this issue more thoroughly. And they did that at the beginning of the year, shortly after we and other NGOs had launched our own report and challenge to government. And that work made a preliminary report to stakeholders in March, and it substantiated the concerns that we had raised and reflected similar conclusions to that of the European Commission's science report. Unfortunately, since that workshop, the Government Science Unit has gone relatively quiet on it, and they haven't published it, and we're still awaiting that publication.
Ah, okay, that's interesting. You had other recommendations in the Dirtier Than Coal report, specifically about the subsidies regime, which is already encouraging the use of burning trees in power stations in the UK.
Yeah. Okay, well, there's a couple. I mean, firstly, we called for no subsidies to be made available for new biomass power stations. And we welcomed government's recent commitment to cap subsidies for that sector. They've capped it at 400 megawatts, which would allow a couple of big plants to go ahead still. And so we're still calling for that to be reduced, you know, to zero, so to effectively rule out public support for new dedicated power plants. For conversion of coal power plants over to wood, we would like to see two things. I mean, firstly, we would like to see the overall size of this sector to effectively reflect sustainable supply. So we don't think the government's original aspirations of, well, up to 6 gigawatts of wood power are at all realistic. And so the size of support for this sector should reflect that. And secondly, we should amend the sustainability standards so that it simply precludes the use of whole trees for energy generation. Because there isn't a problem using offcuts from sawmills, even arising from forestry operations that are going ahead anyway to provide wood for other markets. We can use those for energy generation. They would be better used, incidentally, in more efficient forms of energy generation, like combined heat and power or just heat generation. But for power generation, we should just amend those standards so it says you can use those arisings, you can use the wood waste and such like, but you can't use wood from a tree trunk, as it were. And that would mean that you don't get whole trees used, and that's what causes significant amounts of carbon debt.
That was Harry Highton, Head of Climate and Energy Policy at the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds. One of the firms that has been receiving large amounts of public subsidy from the government to convert the UK's largest coal-fired power station to burning trees is Drax. Earlier this year, Campaign Group Biofuel Watch put in a Freedom of Information request to find out what contact Drax had been having with the Department for Energy and Climate Change. I asked Almuth Ernsting from Biofuel Watch what that request had revealed.
Well, it revealed two really interesting bits of information. The first one was that there were a lot of contacts between Drax and DEC, the Department for Energy and Climate Change, before DEC announced in the run-up to this decision about long-term subsidies, so the renewables obligation for biomass. And very interestingly, well before the decision was made, the proposal, the final proposal for those long-term subsidies was put before Parliament in March, well before then, Drax made it clear to DEC that they had a satisfying reassurance that they would get subsidy levels that they would need and they had wanted, and that they would therefore go ahead with the conversion. So that really indicates that there were indications and promises made to industry before the statutory instrument really went through the parliamentary process, and that's concerning. The second really interesting bit of information is that the documents show that Drax and DEC have known since quite early on in 2012 that there's really only one type of biomass that Drax or any of the companies converting from coal to biomass can burn, and that is wood from slow-growing trees with a low bark content. Now, many of the claims are in defense of, on the one hand, Drax's biomass investment, on the other hand, the government's support for coal to biomass conversions has relied on claims about, you know, range of other types of biomass being burned, such as agricultural residues, forestry residues, which are largely ruled out because most of them are really high in bark. And all, for example, short rotation coppicing, which again, as the documents have revealed, is not a suitable feedstock. And it's not suitable for purely technical reasons. It's simply because any type of biomass other than wood from slow-growing trees with little bark causes the boilers to corrode. So right, that's been known, clearly been known for well over a year, and yet had been kept pretty much secret, and really feel that a lot of the claims that have been made have really been pretty misleading in view of that knowledge.
Right. So going back to that first point, from a public perspective, it looked like there was a public consultation going on about to what extent subsidies should be given to biomass, and presumably all kinds of environmental NGOs and scientists at that point were making representations to government to say actually they shouldn't be getting any support at all because this isn't actually carbon neutral, this is actually, you know, potentially worse than coal in terms of emissions. And yet you're saying that the government seems to have secretly given an assurance to Drax that they would be getting this subsidy before any of that had been resolved.
Yes, absolutely. It's really worrying. There were actually a number of consultations. There was quite late on a consultation on biomass sustainability where, you know, we certainly know that a number of NGOs, you know, raised serious concerns, especially over the use of old trees, which we now know is what Drax will largely have to rely upon. Mm. And Drax were definitely satisfied that they had some sort of assurances at a time when no public announcement had been made and those issues hadn't been resolved. And also, under the parliamentary procedure, it had to at least be put before Parliament. And that didn't happen until March. So, yeah, there are really concerns of the way this was handled and how democratic or not democratic the process was.
Yeah, yeah, I've recently come across this European Commission report that was, I'm sure you must know about, was released in April after Client Earth took the European Commission to court for not releasing it, which was a literature review about the carbon accounting for biomass. And that clearly states that this assumption that biomass is carbon neutral is a false assumption on which all this policy is predicated. Now, that actually was released in April, and nevertheless, the government has now released even more announcements of subsidies for biomass, the Contracts for Difference. So even though this evidence is quite clearly in the public domain about the climate change impacts of biomass, that they're still refusing to acknowledge that and continuing to announce new subsidies. There seems to be a kind of willful blindness to the science here.
Yeah, absolutely. And the science has been really, really clear that especially burning wood from whole trees for electricity results in a really considerable carbon debt. The only, you know, the only discussions among scientists are just how major the carbon debt is,
right.
But it is very significant. There's, you know, there's not a single study that we've ever come across, not a peer-reviewed study that we've ever come across that suggests otherwise.
Right.
Or that especially suggests that it's carbon neutral and that carbon can be largely ignored. Now, what's quite interesting is that around the time when the subsidies proposal still was put before the House of Lords Committee, DEC were actually quite candid in saying that their, at the time, proposed support levels for coal to biomass conversions had a lot to do with their desire to keep coal power stations open.
Mm.
And indeed, Vince Cable, they said in a quite recent interview with the Financial Times that without a green investment bank loan for drugs may have had to shut down altogether, and that a lot of this is really over energy security, and indicating that a lot of it is really simply about keeping the old power stations open rather than having to shut them.
Mm.
So there's really clear indications from the government that much of this is really not to do with climate or emissions reductions, and that the agenda is, to quite a significant part, really been something quite different.
Yeah. So the Green Investment Bank gave Drax also, this is like an additional subsidy, if you like, £100 million towards the end of last year, and that's not even one of the Green Investment Bank's four priority areas as mandated by the government, is it?
Exactly, it isn't. There was actually two loans. There was a Green Investment Bank loan for £100 million, but there was also an additional subsequent loan guarantee by the government to drugs for their conversion.
Mm.
So they have had a lot of public sector support,
mm.
In addition to the private finance that they've been able to raise.
Yep.
In how far the private finance was stimulated and made possible by the Green Investment Bank is not entirely clear.
Right. So this is both kind of taxpayers' money, well, more taxpayers' money, because also ROCs and Contract for Difference are all forms of taxpayer money that are going to support burning trees in what used to be coal-fired power stations.
Yeah. I mean, ROCs are not paid for taxation. They are paid through more so energy bills.
Right.
But they're still paid by the general public.
Do you know how many tons of wood Drax will be burning every year if it is allowed to fully convert to burning trees?
Yes, they will need to burn. Well, the aim is to convert 50% to wood pellets. And if they go ahead with those 50%, with this 50% conversion, they would need to burn pellets made from almost 16 million tons of wood every year. And by comparison, the UK's total annual wood production is only 10 million tons. So it's 1.6 times as much as the entire UK wood production for all markets and purposes.
Mm. I mean, you say wood pellets, but we now know that those pellets are derived, as you say, and also from the Freedom of Information documents that you received, Drax will be sourcing that from whole trees that are being imported.
Yeah.
And not content with all the trouble that they've caused so far, the Green Investment Bank looking to invest more in biomass, by the sounds of it.
Yeah, they made it quite clear in their forecast that they intend to invest more in biomass. And right now, our particular concern is whether the first biomass project in Scotland that they will fund might end up being a large biomass power station at Grangemouth that was recently approved by the Scottish Government, despite, you know, quite major opposition.
But you've discovered a conflict of interest within the Green Investment Bank in relation to this project.
Well, at the face of it, definitely. The chairman of the Green Investment Bank is Lord Smith of Galvin, who is also the chair of SSE, who holds 50% of the shares in Forth Energy.
Okay. Some people might know them as Scottish and Southern Electricity, that might be their electricity supplier. Yeah.
So that certainly, to us, indicates a really, you know, a real question over conflict of interest. In fact, one of our colleagues asked about that at the GIB annual review announcement equivalent of an AGM that they had just over a week ago. And basically, Lord Smith was simply saying, oh, well, it wouldn't be a problem because he won't be voting on this particular funding decision. But the problem is that Lord Smith is on all sorts of committees within the Green Investment Bank. He is the chairman, and he is heavily involved in drawing up the policies according to which schemes are being approved. And of course, if schemes then meet the policy, it become pretty much a foregone conclusion that they are in with a really good chance of attracting the funding.
I mean, I don't think this is something that is particularly at the forefront of public awareness, that coal stations are being converted to burn trees in order to stay, to keep operating. But also there are various proposals, like the one you mentioned at Grangemouth, for new dedicated power plants that would burn trees. I mean, how much of this is going on in the UK right now? What stage is everything at? And what does this imply for just the amount of wood trees that we might be shipping in from the rest of the world?
What we calculated about a month ago was looking at all the industry plans that have been announced and that are in the pipeline, taking out the ones that at that stage had been abandoned or rejected. If you add up the wood demand created by them all, you'd be looking at something between 80 and 90 million tons of wood every year, so 8 to 9 times the UK's total wood production. So it's a massive new demand for wood. The government in their UK bioenergy strategy have admitted that they expect 80% of wood-based biomass to be imported in future. Now, the majority of the imported wood right now comes from British Columbia and the southern US. So it's coming from two regions where highly biodiverse ancient and carbon-rich forests continue to be destroyed by logging industries and continue to be converted to monoculture plantations. So there are really huge concerns over what this new demand for wood will mean for forests.
That was Almuth Ernsting of Biofuel Watch. The review of the science on the carbon emissions of burning trees in power stations that was conducted by the European Commission's Science Department was published in April this year following a legal case brought by environmental law firm Client Earth and campaign group BirdLife Europe. I spoke to Giuseppe Nastasi of Client Earth on the phone from Brussels to find out more about the European Commission's reluctance to release the report.
First of all, this is an important report. It's a literature review, so a review of all available scientific literature, which is carried out by the Commission's Joint Research Centre, which is the research body of the Commission. So it's a very authoritative source. We first submitted the request to obtain access to the document as it was at the time, so a draft of the document back on the 1st of August 2012. But unfortunately, we had several communications from first the JRC and then the Secretariat General of the Commission, basically failing to give us the access to the report and at the same time failing to explain why they were not giving us access to the report. And this went until the end of 2012. On 21st of December 2012, out of good faith, we wrote to the Commission, basically giving them a notice that given that they hadn't yet provided access to the document and not even explained why they were not doing so, we intended to initiate court proceedings. We went to court, and after we went to court, it was only in March 2013 that the Commission finally published the document, and with it sent us a letter explaining, between quotes, the reasons for this delay. Actually, they didn't really provide many reasons. They continued saying that they were not discussing the study because the study was still ongoing, but the European law allows the applicants for this type of information to access also the drafts of studies or documents, so this was not really a valid reason. And they also mentioned some copyright questions, but very vaguely, without really providing any explanation. What we see is that this is common practice for the Commission.
Right. And when you finally saw the report, what was the central finding?
Well, the central finding was pretty important. They conclude from this review of the literature that, and I quote, the assumption of biogenic carbon neutrality is not valid under policy-relevant time horizons if carbon stock changes in the forest are not accounted for. What this means is that the current assumptions in European law and European policy on biomass, that biomass is carbon neutral, is not valid, especially, if particular types of biomass are used, for example, whole trees, stem wood, etc. So these rules come with possibilities for member states to give renewable energy subsidies, so taxpayers' money, and this is all based on an assumption that the JRC finds from the literature review is invalid.
Right.
So it is a pretty important, as we can see, is a pretty important conclusion to reach, and we believe this calls for an important and significant review of the policy as it stands now.
So this report is authoritative, high-level literature review, and it undermines the central assumption at the heart of the EU's biomass policy.
Yes.
How has the Commission responded now that they've been forced to publish finally this report?
Well, I'm not sure there has been a final answer from the Commission. The Commission has been, well, for a long time now, expected to come forward with an assessment of whether or not sustainability rules are needed for the use of solid biomass for energy, which the Commission hasn't yet done. And if this assessment finds that sustainability rules are needed, the Commission should also make a legislative proposal. But as I was saying, the Commission has not done so yet.
Do you think there is a good basis for the European Union saying we should be acting with the precautionary principle in mind, and the very least should be a moratorium on support for biomass?
Well, there have been calls from the Parliament, especially from certain quarters in the Parliament, to have a reassessment of the policy. But the problem is that the Commission seems not to have really taken these issues on board with the attention that I think would be necessary given the scale and the relevance of the issue.
Is there some kind of urgent further legal action that you could possibly bring to kind of halt what now is obviously a wrong-headed policy?
Well, it's difficult to put everything in terms of legal actions. Of course, there are aspects that that we can tackle with legal actions, for example, access to information, etc. But there are others that have to be addressed on the political level. This is the more general renewable energy policy and biomass policy is one of these cases. So it is important that the public should be aware, and that explains our request to access the JRC report. The public should be aware of the concerns and should put pressure on decision makers and politicians, well, first of all, to be aware of it, but also to act on it.
That was Giuseppe Nastasi of Client Earth. But what about the other impacts of burning trees in power stations? Where is up to 90 million tonnes of trees every year going to come from if we go ahead with this policy in the UK? I called up Rachel Smolker of Biofuel Watch and Energy Justice Network in Burlington, Vermont, to find out.
So it looks like the UK and Europe have a lot of incentives in place to scale up biomass, you know, essentially the burning of wood in power stations. Where's all that wood going to come from? Is it going to come from you guys over there in the States?
Well, right now, most of it is coming from the southeastern U.S., where we have huge tree plantations that were actually planted for the pulp and paper industry for the most part. But as the pulp and paper industry has moved elsewhere, these tree plantations remain. And so this is creating a new market for the wood from those tree plantations, you know, in addition to what's still a very big pulp and paper industry in that area. And then British Columbia is also a major source of pellets going to Europe, and that's in part because of the beetle infestation that damaged a lot of forests out there, and the BC government basically said, hey, let's make use of all this beetle-damaged wood and sort of use that as a Trojan horse to increase cutting and pelletizing of BC forests and shipping them to Europe as well. So those are the two main sources right now, but of course these companies are eyeing other locations for the future, you know, Brazil and Africa and so on. They're realizing that they're going to need to expand their horizons to supply such a huge, vast demand that they have created.
I was somewhat distressed to read the BBC's environment correspondent Roger Harabin saying that some of the trees are coming to be burnt in the Drax power station in the UK. Is not only coming from US tree plantations, but also from natural swamp forests in North Carolina. We haven't even started scaling up this technology yet, or this fuel source, and that's already happening. That's a bit worrying, isn't it?
It's very worrying, and the you know, we've been saying this all along. You simply cannot supply that huge quantity of wood. You know, the industry will say they often make the claim that they're just using quote-unquote waste and residues from other forestry operations, but there's just nowhere near the amount of wood available as waste and residues, and we know that they're using whole trees cut specifically for, you know, pelletizing and burning for electricity. And yes, it's very disturbing that we see already at this only really the tip of the iceberg, what could potentially be happening, that they're cutting natural swamp forests in North Carolina. And it comes as absolutely no surprise. I mean, I think that's what's happening in BC as well, that, you know, the idea of, you know, you've created a huge new market for wood. And when you do that, people will cut what's accessible and can be cut. And that can very easily lead to cutting natural forests as well as tree plantations if those are made available.
Yeah, and this doesn't seem to be waste wood. Like you say, that's something that the industry seems to suggest, that, you know, we can just use kind of sawmill dust and bits of random logs, what have you. But we're actually seeing whole trees being felled, by the sounds of it.
Yes, and in some cases, you know, the term waste has been sort of morphed and changed into different meanings. So it's not just, you know, sawdust from a wood mill that's already operational. It's trees that aren't suitable for logs are considered waste. So in other words, harvesting operations can be much more intense now because there's a market for a lot of the wood that may have been left in the past, including, you know, limbs and branches and so on, but also including trees that maybe have some irregularities that make them less useful for logs, but they can be ground up and turned into pellets.
So how many spare trees do you have in the US there that you can give us to burn over here?
Well, you know, my response to that is, you know, if you look historically at deforestation, and I don't, when I say deforestation, I also emphasize to exclude tree plantations from that definition, because a lot of natural forest has been converted to tree plantations, which is essentially the same thing as, you know, cornfield. You know, these tree plantations of eucalyptus or pine, they are, you know, industrial monocultures. They're treated with fertilizers and agrochemicals. They don't support biodiversity. They're not forests. But if you look at the scale of deforestation over the past, you know, 100 years, you realize that we don't have forests to spare anywhere on this planet, and particularly in light of what's happening with climate change. And we know that one of the best lines of defense is to allow forests to grow and regrow and regenerate. So it's absurd to be creating a huge new demand for wood at this particular time, especially.
Yeah, no, I'm interested that you should say that, because you look at Jim Hansen's 350 scenario, and one of the assumptions of it is that we are going to stop deforestation and start reforesting. So exactly, this seems to be going in exactly the wrong direction. I mean, the other thing the industry talks about is marginal and degraded land. I mean, do we have much of that globally? Is there much capacity there? What's that about?
Well, that's a term that, you know, has been used to create, again, this image that, yes, there's tons of land out there that could be turned into tree plantations. But the fact is that, I mean, to a large extent, that's land in the global south. Because, you know, if you look at where plant biomass grows on a global scale. Obviously in the south, in the tropics, things grow faster and more furiously than they do up here. And the definition of marginal land is kind of basically like, if this land is not right now being used to contribute to, you know, global trade in some way, then it's quote-unquote marginal. Whereas, you know, there are peasant farmers and indigenous people and local communities that consider that land central to their livelihoods, but because they're not part of the global trade and so on, their contribution is largely invisible to the people who make these assessments. You know, they go out and spread out the map of the world and say, oh, lots of biomass grows here, and nobody seems to be using this land right here. Well, they don't have to live on the ground there, so they don't notice, but, you know, much of that land is actually in use, you know. Most new land coming into agriculture is coming at the expense of forests at this point, because we don't have a lot of room to expand, and people are using land to the best of its effect.
Right. We've already kind of run an experiment, if you like, haven't we, with this kind of thing. Over the last 10 or 15 years, we incentivized agrofuels. We gave subsidies in the rich north, and we ended up doing a lot of land grabbing in order to grow agrofuels or biofuels to drive cars in Europe and the US. What were the impacts of that in terms of land grabbing?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, when you create a new market, you create an enticement for investors, basically, when they realize that there's value to be had from, for example, growing crops for bioenergy, then you get speculative investment and you get more of a demand for that land. And those who are less, again, part of that sort of global economy and trade scheme, particularly peasant farmers, indigenous people, local communities, end up at the short end of the stick. Their land is suddenly desirable to rich people in some other country who want to be able to drive SUVs. And so the land grabbing problem has really escalated just in light of biofuels and also, you know, concern about food security and agricultural production as well. There was a report by the International Land Coalition showing that of the land grabs globally, and many of these are in Africa, but also elsewhere, that something like 3/4 of the ones that they were really able to get good information about were for the production of biofuel crops. So you can see that, you know, this speculative investment, this new market for crops for biofuels is driving, to a very large extent, the sweep of land grabs that we're seeing.
And are there any signs of a new land grab for biomass, plantations dedicated to biomass?
Yeah, well, and just to add to the, you know, what I said previously, all of the impacts that we've seen, including the price of food rising as a result of crops. You know, we put, I think something like 40% of our corn crop into ethanol here in the United States. So this biofuels has a huge impact also on driving the price of food up, as well as land grabs. And this is all of those impacts that we've seen so far, which are now, you know, widely accepted and acknowledged by many. You know, even the IMF has recently called for change in biofuel policies. And that's all just providing something like 3% of our global transport energy from biofuels. So it's just a tiny drop in the bucket of energy that we're producing, and a huge impact because of the land issue. It takes a lot of land. And as far as, you know, land grabs for biomass go, for specifically for, you know, wood pellets, say, to ship to Europe, we're only just beginning to see, you know, the potential for that to happen. And there's every reason to expect that we will be seeing land grabs. Certainly we've seen plenty of land grabs for tree plantations in general, for pulp and paper industry and, you know, other purposes. So this is just adding to the demand for wood in a very major way. So we can expect that we'll see just more of that.
Okay. Is demand going to come from anywhere else other than Europe or North America? Or are other countries also incentivizing this fuel source?
Yeah, there are other countries. Korea has been looking in investing as well. Europe is currently by far the largest set of countries that's been looking to hoover up the world's forests. The U.S. is behind Europe in that respect also, because we haven't taken on targets for emissions reduction to the same extent that Europe has, and that's part of what's driving Europe's supposedly reducing emissions from burning trees. Whereas here in the U.S., you know, we have state-by-state renewable portfolio standards, and we have other incentives in place that are supporting it. But we also have more forests of our own here to burn, and we haven't created quite the same demand as you've got going in Europe. So yet is the key.
Right. Are we seeing NGOs in the Global South starting to express concerns about biomass?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You know, people are very well aware of this issue. They've seen what's happened with biofuels and, you know, for transportation fuels, and are not happy about it. And they are very clearly aware that this has the potential to create yet another wave of land grabs and tree plantations. So World Rainforest Movement just did a report which just came out recently. I think it was called something, Tree Plantations in the South to Generate Energy in the North, a New Threat to Communities and Forests. And this also has some detailed examples of some of the just the beginnings of investments in tree plantations in various countries in the South to basically export mostly to Europe at this point. La Via Campesina, of course, is very concerned about the land grab issue. That's been a major focus for them, and they're certainly well aware of this. Global Forest Coalition, which Biofuel Watch is a focal point, has done, you know, reports on biomass, electricity, and wood bioenergy as well. And we are a coalition of indigenous peoples groups, mostly forest-dependent indigenous peoples groups. So there's a lot of expanding awareness about this.
With land grabs, do we actually see conflicts when that happens? I mean, people presumably don't give up their land easily. Do you know the kind of mechanisms of that, and what kind of stresses it puts on the rural poor?
Well, it's, you know, just imagine somebody came and told you that, you know, where you live is now not yours anymore, and you need to just move off and go somewhere else, who cares where, and try and make a living, you know. And if you don't, we'll, you know, bring out the heavy guns and force you to do that. It's often leading to bloody conflicts with people being, you know, killed and injured, and a lot of suffering and damage is resulting from these land grabs. And it's, you know, very often people who are already living close to the edge and are vulnerable, and they don't have, you know, their rights are not necessarily recognized even by the countries they live in. And here there's, you know, wealthy investors being welcomed into the country and, you know, brought right into their communities and said, hey, you can have this land for a price, you know, we'll just get rid of the people. So it's often very violent. And it's especially women, you know, who suffer with these land grabs as well, because, you know, again, they carry the burden of responsibility for feeding their families and also have the least formalized recognition of their land rights generally globally.
I mean, I think one of the things we're kind of relying on to make this appear sustainable in the UK and the EU is things like certification systems like the Forest Stewardship Council. And does that help alleviate any of these problems?
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would just add to what I said previously that, you know, the standards for biomass, which UK is now considering specifically, do not include, you know, social justice concerns under their sustainability issues. So, you know, they would consider, you know, wood biomass coming from, you know, someplace where there had been a, you know, bloody displacement of people, that would be considered sustainable under the proposed standards for biomass in the UK. The thing about these standards is if you are a company that wants to be able to say that you only burn, you know, certified wood pellets, you can basically go shopping and find somebody who will give you that certification. Those certifications you know, are granted by a handful of consultancies that are in the business of granting certifications. So it's in their interest to be able to do that. In many cases, there's absolutely no verification or on the ground, you know, what is actually happening. It's really a matter of filling, checking boxes on a check sheet. You know, was this cut in a sustainable way? Yes. Oh, okay. So certified sustainable then. There's very little substance to these certification schemes. And, you know, they sound good and on paper. You can have all kinds of, you know, strong principled requirements. But if there's nobody and there's no mechanism to ensure that that's actually really what's happening, then they're meaningless. And even, you know, FSC is considered one of the you know, more respectable certification. But, you know, among other things, FSC certifies industrial tree plantations. And if your goal is to protect forests and call that sustainable stewardship of forests, then just allowing endless conversion of natural forests into industrial tree plantations cannot be considered sustainable. So, for example, eucalyptus plantations, that's an introduced tree in Brazil, FSC will certify eucalyptus plantations in Brazil as, you know, sustainable. So, yeah, these certification programs are really a sham, in my view.
Okay. What's happening in the U.S. around biomass in terms of community resistance to biomass projects?
Yeah, well, we have, you know, growing awareness. There are a lot of communities that have been targeted for facilities burning wood. And a lot of the resistance to them is based on the health concerns, because these, you know, burning wood releases a lot of smoke. And in particular, some hazardous substances. I live in Vermont. We have one of the older facilities in the country located here in Burlington, Vermont. And it's the largest source of air pollution in the state. There's some close to 70 pollutants that come out of the stack of that facility. And there's growing awareness that especially the particulates and fine particulates are very, very damaging to human health.
Okay. What do you think the best way to fight this is? I mean, the driver of all this seems to be the subsidies that the North is offering for these fuels, operating under the assumption that this is all carbon neutral. Is this the thing that really needs to be challenged?
Yeah, I mean, I think the targets and mandates for bioenergy need to be eliminated and the subsidies removed. The problem that we are faced with in opposing this is that it's sort of a, you know, a domino effect. While we want to point out that burning biomass for electricity is not clean, it's not green, it's extremely dangerous and destructive in various different ways, fracking has its problems as well, and solar panels have their problems, and wind energy has its problems. We need a united front to say we want clean energy. And part of what that means is that we have to really get serious about saying we want less energy, because there just simply isn't any alternative. All of the, you know, quote-unquote alternative energy forms have their own problems. So if we really want to be realistic about it, we need to get very serious about reducing the amount of energy that we use here in the North, especially in industrialized countries. We need a united movement that will call for that.
That was Rachel Smolkler of Biofuel Watch and Energy Justice Network, bringing our look at biomass to a close. We didn't receive a reply to our request to interview someone from the Department for Energy and Climate Change. And the Labour Shadow Environment Secretary, Caroline Flint, was too busy to speak with us, and her team did not respond to our request for a written statement. This programme will be archived with a fully referenced post at climateradio.org, and how the UK and the EU respond to the information about the impacts of burning trees for electricity that is now in the public domain is largely down to you. Be bold. There's lots at stake.